Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who talks about the recent arrest of former Peruvian spy chief Vladimiro Montesinos and his long relationship with the CIA. Dr. Quentin Young, coordinator with Physicians for a National Health Program, who examines the fundamental problems of managed care that a patient's Bill of Rights, now being debated in Congress, does not address. And Ron Daniels of the Centre for Constitutional Rights, who discusses a campaign for electoral reform being launched at his group's pro-democracy convention in Philadelphia on June the 29th through to July the 1st. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In an effort to improve the performance of schools, districts have turned to something called Educational Maintenance Organizations, EMOs. These EMOs have promised to demonstrate the power of a profit-driven approach to education, with benefits to students and investors alike. Yet, as The Nation magazine reports, even the flagship EMO, Edison Schools Incorporated, has a long way to go to close the gap between practice and theory. Edison Incorporated is a $1.3 billion corporation that currently runs 113 schools, teaching 57,000 students. But despite their size and investment during the past decade, they're a corporation that has yet to show a profit. No matter, say Wall Street analysts who continue to push Edison stock as a wise investment. The deep-seated belief in EMOs in general, and Edison in particular, stems from two fundamental assumptions. The first is that neighborhood public schools are dead and for-profit schools are the wave of the future. The second is summed up by Wall Street commentator John Rubino, who states, "People who like the idea of school choice now control the White House and most state governments. Add it all up and you get a $400 billion market that's ripe for the taking." Maybe so, but the model has yet to live up to expectations. Advocates of EMOs bemoan wasted dollars in public schools and cite the need for the efficient use of resources. Yet Edison typically spends more per student than comparable public schools. To even look profitable on paper requires Edison to use creative accounting, forcing school districts to pay for lunches, transportation, and other costs. Perhaps the situation is best summed up by the somber tone of Edison's own annual report, which stated, "We have not yet demonstrated that public schools can be profitably managed by private companies, and we are not certain when we will become profitable, if at all." When it comes to treatment of heart ailments, advice from the American Heart Association is viewed by many Americans as good as gold. But more doctors are questioning the Heart Association's recommendations, according to Mother Jones magazine. In recent months, doctors claim that the AHA has a conflict of interest when an anti-clotting drug they praise is made by a drug company, Genentech, that has donated millions of dollars to the Heart Association. The drug in question is called TPA, an expensive treatment for stroke victims. According to a recent annual report, the AHA says TPA saves lives and should be used in upwards of 400,000 stroke cases a year, a dramatic increase from its current usage. What the Heart Association does not advertise is that Genentech has given the nonprofit organization over $11 million in corporate donations over the last decade, including a $2.5 million gift for a new conference center at the association's headquarters in Dallas. Further, there are significant side effects from TPA. A study found increased numbers of brain hemorrhages associated with the anti-clotting drug that the American Heart Association glosses over. Dr. Robert McNamara of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine says, "We've been hoodwinked. The whole thing is fueled by drug company money. It leaves a bad taste in your mouth." The news magazine In These Times reports that the Pentagon has unveiled its latest high-tech weapon for crowd control, a high-energy microwave beam that can be mounted on the back of a truck. The U.S. military hopes to use this new high-tech non-lethal device during peacekeeping, border patrols, and to contain domestic disturbances. The weapon works by producing short bursts of microwave energy that can cause a burning feeling on human skin and can be fired from up to 700 feet away. People hit by the high energy beam feel a brief shock, but, say military officials, no lasting effects. Colonel George Fenton explained, "You can walk out of the beam and the pain goes away. There are no long lasting effects." Public health critics are not so sure, who compare the new weapon to a militarized version of a microwave oven. Some scientists worry if the energy beam is used at close range, it could cook a person's eyeball. They speculate that the high energy beam could possibly lead to eye cataracts and cancer. Despite the criticism, the Pentagon stands by its claims that the zapper is safe to use in breaking up threatening crowds. The U.S. military says only one test has resulted in a burn on a human face. Yet most long-term studies of the energy beam and its health effects are still classified. Information about how long the energy burst can go on before inflicting long-term health damage or even death also remains secret. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Rich Frazier. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
Vladimiro Montesinos, former Peruvian spy chief and right-hand man to ousted Peruvian President Alberto Fujimori, was arrested in Caracas, Venezuela on June the 23rd. He managed to evade an international manhunt for 8 months, but now faces a possible life sentence on charges of weapons trafficking, human rights abuses, and corruption. 56-year-old Montesinos was flown in handcuffs and a bulletproof vest to Lima and was transferred to a high-security prison for interrogation. The de facto head of Peru's intelligence service, Montesinos collaborated for years with the CIA, managing a large Peruvian anti-drug operation set up by the CIA in the early 1990s. Even though Montesinos was considered a controversial figure for years in the Clinton administration, American officials still went to him to lobby for human rights votes against Cuba in The Hague and to protect U.S. business interests in Peru. Larry Burns is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about the relationship between the U.S. and Vladimiro Montesinos and the role that the relationship may have played in the conviction and imprisonment of U.S. citizen Lori Berenson. Berenson was recently convicted, in a second trial, of collaborating with Peruvian guerrillas and was sentenced to 20 years.
Montesinos was quintessentially the bad guy, the Latin American bad guy, the maker of dictators, the Rasputin of Peru. He was an extraordinarily bizarre figure who was at the very center of illicit operations which earned him tens of millions of dollars, which are salted away in a series of offshore banking places like the Cayman Islands, where he had a bank account of $30 million. Mind you, this was a humble military officer who had had once been cashiered by the Peruvian military for being a CIA agent, and then made his comeback and became, without question, the man behind the throne, behind Alberto Fujimori, the now ousted president of Peru. I think that of equal note is the fact that during the 10 years that Montesinos served President Fujimori, the United States intelligence was extremely well aware of what was going on. And in fact, there were a number of cables coming from CIA offices in Lima, which were detailing the corruption of Fujimori and raising questions whether the United States should continue its policy of a close embrace of Fujimori's Peru, of course, which was at the very center of the Clinton administration Latin American policy, that there were 34 democracies and one dictatorship in Latin America. And of course, the dictatorship was Cuba, and one of the 34 democracies was Peru, which was an obscene conclusion to come to, given the fact that the Fujimori-Montesinos brotherhood systematically violated human rights, killed Peruvian students and other dissidents, were at the very heart of the drug trafficking, and were the masterminds of the detention of the American citizen Laurie Berenson. There is no question that U.S. policy during the Clinton administration was to put the Laurie Berenson case second behind U.S. policy, which was emphasizing quickly dispatching the guerrilla forces in Peru and dealing with the reduction of narcotic trafficking.
That kind of answers the question, but why do you think the United States stayed so quiet about this and did not actually even answer the Berenson's pleas most of the time?
The U.S. policy, in fact, we have written a letter to Senator Biden calling upon the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to hold hearings on U.S. policy during the 1990s to Peru and the status of the Berenson case. I think that such hearings could very likely establish that the United States was well aware of the full scope of not only the corruption of the Montesinos Fujimori regime, but also the human rights violations. It also knew the status of the Berenson case and the fact that the Peruvian authorities had a relatively weak case against her, surely not one that warranted treason charges. That was the word that was used against someone who was not even a national of that country. I mean, Peru is simply a very corrupt country, and I doubt very much whether Toledo, the incoming president, is going to have the ability to, or necessary the stamina to confront the old regime and its loyalty to Montesinos. I, of course, am far more interested in the conduct of the United States during this period than what was going on in Peru. What was going on in Peru was standard stuff in terms of these pseudo-democracies that abound in Latin America, that are democracies only in name, and in the tribute that the United States gives them because they are not Cuba. I think that the amateur nature of U.S. policy towards Latin America and the fact that it was so derelict in abandoning the fate of one of its nationals, Laurie Berenson, to such a corrupt political process as that existing in Peru, that's what I think is the real scandal.
That was Larry Burns, Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. To contact the Council, call area code 202-216-9261 or visit their website at www.coha.org. The House and Senate are currently debating a patients' rights bill that supporters hope will compensate for some of the worst abuses of the managed healthcare system. The current system evolved after the failure of privatised national healthcare legislation proposed by President Clinton during his first term. Dozens of insurance companies now provide a patchwork of restrictive coverage plans, while more than 40 million Americans have no coverage at all. The US healthcare system is by far the most expensive and flawed in the industrialised world. Despite national pride in the high quality of American medical care, the Institute of Medicine recently found that nearly 100,000 patients die in hospitals annually due to physician error. In calling for reform, consumer groups, some healthcare providers, and a small band in Congress have proposed single-payer universal health coverage as an antidote to the current corporate profit-driven model. One of the groups which has long advocated a universal system is Physicians for a National Health Program, or PNHP. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with PNHP's coordinator, Dr. Quentin Young, who has practiced medicine in Chicago for five decades and been in the forefront of the struggle for healthcare reform. He talks about the movement for universal care and the prospects for change to substantively address America's healthcare crisis.
Physicians for National Health Program was founded in 1988 when 100 physicians across the country signed a declaration calling for, in brief, a national health insurance plan, single payer, best understood as Medicare for everybody, but without the encumbrances that Medicare is burdened with: no co-pays, no deductibles, no caps, no first-day hospital charges, and of course, a comprehensive pharmacy coverage, parity for mental health, long-term care, in a word, a modern social justice kind of healthcare system. I would say our greatest achievement in the little over a decade is the high-quality scientific studies that make the case for single-payer national health insurance and make the case against for-profit corporate takeover of our health system, which tragically coincided that same dozen years.
And when you say makes the case, are you referring to how your studies have shown that it would actually save money to have this kind of system?
Well, we make the case in every way. First and foremost, economically, since the cost of the health system is on the top of most people's agendas, the politicians, the business community, and indeed the public as patients. So that's a very ready-made case, not only with the data we have in our own country, but from the experiences of the 18 industrial democratic countries of the world, each of whom over the years has chosen to make national responsibility for health care of their people. They all do it in a comprehensive way, covering everybody for typically half or even less than half of what we spend per capita for our faulty system. But beyond the fiscal, we make the case for better quality and reverse the trends toward danger and unsafety that is being carefully chronicled most recently by the Institute of Medicine, showing nearly 100,000 people perish in hospitals from errors, and make the case for preventive medicine, for preserving patient-doctor relationships and access to specialty care, emergency room care, and so on. Data are unequivocally compelling to show that the public is being ripped off.
Well, then what's in the way of that, since the system is so far from perfect now?
Well, we spend a lot of time both facing those oppositions and trying to understand them. And it turns out that at the top of the list are ideology, false ideology. That is to say, the American people have been brainwashed against government programs and taxes, both of which are components of the proposal we make. And it's ironic, the standard joke we make, which is bitter humor, namely, the little old lady who passionately begs her doctor, "Don't let the government get their hands on my Medicare." Unaware, is she, that Medicare is a government program, a big government program, a very successful program, and yet it's under attack by reactionary forces who want to privatize it, who want to force people into HMOs, which have already proven their dysfunction and counterproductivity. These Bill of Rights are attempts to address that, and as far as we're concerned, that's desirable, to give people protection, but any illusion that that would solve the problems with our healthcare system is just that, a sad illusion.
Do you see any hope for your noble cause with the physicians who are part of your organization getting from where we are to anything resembling a more just system that you are talking about?
I really do. My optimism resides on two or three things. One, and first and foremost, the system we have, costly as it is failing. I mean literally failing. Since we started talking, several hundred more Americans have had bad experience with this system. Most of us, to continue the answer to your question of prospects, have come to believe that it will be one, two, three states enact it and have some experience with it before it becomes national policy. And it turns out that mechanism, that sequence, is very typical for major reforms like women's suffrage. It was enacted in a number of states before it became federally constituted. Workman's comp and unemployment insurance, even Social Security, was tried in the states. So I think it's quite likely that that will be the sequence here. And what I'm saying is that it's happening in that direction faster than we optimists expected.
That was Dr. Quentin Young of Physicians for a National Health Program. Contact the group by calling area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at www.pnhp.org. It's been 9 months since the deeply flawed 2000 presidential election, where the winner, George W. Bush, was chosen by a deeply divided Supreme Court and failed to win a majority of the popular vote. But it seems that the media and most politicians have all but forgotten one of the most controversial elections in US history, while admonishing the nation to put the matter behind us. But not everyone has moved beyond the election. The Center for Constitutional Rights and a coalition of 30 national and regional organizations is convening a pro-democracy convention in Philadelphia on June the 29th through to July the 1st. The convention will address the issues of disenfranchisement of minority voters that occurred in Florida and elsewhere and develop strategies for electoral reform, including the implementation of a Voters' Bill of Rights. Co-sponsors of the event, which include labor unions, civil rights organizations, and groups advocating campaign finance reform, are calling for change that goes well beyond the mere upgrading of election machinery. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ron Daniels, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses the goals of the pro-democracy convention.
This pro-democracy convention is very much about sending a signal to America and to the world that the outrage and anger, frustration generated over the debacle of Election 2000 and the installation of George W. Bush on January 20th, a day so filled with protests that the government declared it a national security event, that it wasn't just about protesting on January 20th, about taking the oath that many of us did at the shadow inauguration that was convened by the Reverend Al Sharpton and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the NACP and other organizations, the massive protest in Tallahassee. It wasn't just about those protests. It is really now about how to translate and transform that anger into a sustained movement for electoral reform that will not only correct the inequities and the malfunctions in the administration of the voting machines and the process, but will open up new vistas of possibilities by introducing ideas that are not so novel in places like Canada and Britain and France and Europe and whatever, or South Africa or the Mexico under its revised electoral system, but seem to be news in America, which is supposed to be the most outstanding of democracy and the bright beacon of promise for the whole world.
There are many who address the issue of proportional representation or amending the Constitution to dramatically change or abolish the Electoral College, saying that the small states will never go along with it, therefore it's kind of a dead issue because you need a constitutional amendment to move forward with that. And there are others, of course, who say that our democracy is stable because it's basically a two-party democracy, and they'll point at governments like that of Italy, where there are many parties involved, and say that's, you know, it's unstable. They've had 40 governments over the last 40 years. How do you respond to those folks who just say multi-party democracy is not the way to go?
Given the extraordinary diversity of the American population and not only ethnically, but along in terms of the political spectrum, that we would fare much better. People would feel much more a part of the system if, in fact, the process was open and you had, if it were easier for political parties to get on the ballot. For example, Ralph Nader, who did a courageous job under some criticism and some fire from the Democrats in particular for his stance. But the problem wasn't really Ralph Nader. The problem was that we don't have instant runoff voting. If we had instant runoff voting, rather than people having to agonize so much about whether Nader would or would not be taking votes away from the Democrats and the lesser evil argument, which in some respects is not totally irrational. I mean, I say that the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans are incremental, not fundamental, but not inconsequential. That is to say, sometimes people tend to gloss over those differences. But if we had instant runoff voting, what happens in that process is if you have three candidates running, then you can rate your candidates, 1, 2, and 3. In the state of Florida, where Ralph Nader ran a relatively strong campaign, got 100,000 votes, the second choice probably of easily 75% of those Nader votes would have gone to Gore on a second choice basis. In a situation where nobody, neither Gore nor Bush, got 50% of the vote, that means those second choices would then have been counted both for Bush and Gore, and it means that Gore would be sitting in the White House now. America is far behind in terms of its sense of participatory democracy in this regard, because in fact, as I've said in so many instances, the biggest political party in America today is really not the Democrats or the Republicans, it's that block of non-voters who are so alienated, frustrated, and feel that that electoral politics are so irrelevant that they don't participate in the process at all, making America one of the lowest countries on the totem pole or ladder of voter participation in the process. Routinely in Canada, England, France, Germany, and other places, the voter turnout is anywhere from 75% to 90% in terms of voter turnout. Only in America do we have this abysmal situation where just about 50% of the people actually bother to register and vote. And it's a great sign of new life in the electorate if it inches up to 52%.
What's your assessment of the mood in the country since the election? You talked about a lot of hope for the future, that this may be certainly a 25-year-long struggle. It's not going to happen overnight. But do you think the pieces of the puzzle are out there to overcome the disillusionment, dispiritedness, and cynicism of a lot of people in our political process?
Yeah, I think so. I'm an optimist by nature, and I like to exude that because I think we are the leaders we've been looking for. My charge and responsibility is not really to become discouraged, but to relentlessly and innovatively and creatively continue to educate, continue to organize, confident that we have the right vision, we have the right values. If we hang in there long enough and listen to the voices of the people and retranslate in the way that they will understand, then ultimately, it may not be in my lifetime, as Martin Luther King say, but someday we will indeed see the promised land of a much more deeply enriched and enhanced democracy, which we can then be really proud of as the bright beacon of democracy for the entirety of the world.
That was Ron Daniels, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. For more information on the pro-democracy convention, call area code 212-614-6452 or visit their website at www.pro-democracy.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's public affairs and news departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikitar. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Rich Fraser, Zelfia Hunter, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.